The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Good morning, everyone. This is Brad McDonald. I'm down here in the studio in the belly of Edstone Hall today, taking the place of Stephen Flurry. Well, I was working on my notes for this program last night when the story came through of this tragic shooting in Virginia, America. Allison Parker and Adam Ward, her cameraman. Allison Parker was a reporter for a local news station, and her cameraman were shot at point-blank range by a disgruntled ex-employee of the TV station. It really is just, it's hard to imagine that this is happening in our world, but this journalist, Allison Parker, was live on television, and this man just walked up to her and shot her point blank, and then shot her cameraman. And this happened on live television yesterday morning. It's shocking and it's devastating. Now, last night my mind was on the subject that I'm going to talk about today. And then this tragedy happens and this story broke all over the news and it's grabbed the world's attention. And it just occurred to me that this is the way it is, isn't it? Our minds just go from one crisis to another. We can be thinking about one tragedy, one crisis, one day. It's major and it's important. It's significant. And then something happens. Another shooting happens. The stock market collapses. One nation invades another nation. There's a race riot here or a race riot there. It's difficult to keep up with the sheer number of crises that are happening around this world and in our nations. Just when our minds begin to focus on a major problem, another one comes along. And our attention is drawn to it for a day or two. And then another one comes along and our focus turns to that next crisis. The sheer number of tragedies, the sheer number of crises makes it hard to really contemplate each one and to learn the lessons that there are to learn from each of these tragedies. It's one tragedy, one crisis after another, after another, after another. Just thinking about what happened yesterday, just one thought that came to my mind was, what's it going to take for more people to think more seriously about the state of their community, about the state of their nation, about the condition of the world that they live in? What's it going to take before more people really think deeply about these awful, awful tragedies and why they're happening and what each tragedy says about our culture and our politics and the state of our nations? America is broken. That's one of the big lessons to take from the tragedy yesterday, but all of the others we've seen this year. America is broken. And then you can apply that same lesson when you look at every other part of this world. When you look at the migrants flowing into Europe by the hundreds of thousands, it's a huge crisis for Europe. Europe is broken. China is broken. Humanity in general is broken. We're falling apart. And I know that sounds pretty pessimistic and fatalistic, but it's the truth. And it's a reality being proved every single day on our television screens and on the news programs that we watch. What's it going to take for you to really explore the truth behind each one of these tragedies? I mean, if you haven't done so already, I'd really encourage you to just let this shooting in Virginia cause you to stop for a moment and to really evaluate your life and evaluate the community that you're living in, evaluate the state of the country that you live in, and really ask some important questions. Why do tragedies like this happen? Why are they occurring so frequently? And what does it say about the health of our societies, the health of our nations? Each one of these tragedies is an opportunity for us, for you, to reflect on the state of humanity and to really ask some fundamental questions about human existence. Sadly, this rarely happens. This rarely happens. This horrible tragedy in Virginia, sadly, will become old news within a few days or a week or two because something is bound to come along to outshine it. I mean, think about where we were on Monday of this week. On Monday this week, the world was talking about a global financial collapse. America's stock market had collapsed 1,000 or 1,100 points. We were all talking about the failure of the financial system. That was just Monday. And now here we are. That story is it's over. At least it's out of the news cycle, largely. And we have another breaking story, another tragedy that has captured our attention. Take this shooting personally. Let it provoke you to do some soul searching, as they say. Where is your world? Where is your nation? Where is your life headed? Really think about those questions and search for the answers and go to God for the answers. And of course, you can go to our material too. You can visit thetrumpet.com and you can read all sorts of articles about all of the events that are happening in this world. But you can also go to the tab and search through our literature. Go to the tab that says literature, and we have all sorts of books that will help you understand your world. And start with Mystery of the Ages. Just scroll down, find Mystery of the Ages, request a print copy, but then open up the PDF and just start reading that. Another great book that'll help you understand your world is America Under Attack by Mr. Gerald Flurry, the editor-in-chief of The Trumpet. That book really does reveal what it reveals the cause of yesterday's tragedy in Virginia. But we do need to stop whenever we see a tragedy like this, whenever we see a calamity like this, and it is a calamity. It is horrible. Can you imagine what kind of world do we live in when a news reporter on live television is gunned down? And this is not happening in Africa, in Middle Africa. This is not happening in South America. This is happening in downtown Virginia. I forgot the name of the town where this happened. But this was a rural community, small town America. We have someone just gunned down on live television. We need to think about that. And we need to think about what kind of condition this world is in and what kind of condition American society is in for that to happen. And the thing is, it's not just happening every now and then. Tragedies like that are happening all the time with increasing frequency. And that really should get all of us asking some fundamental questions and really searching for some answers. Well, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I've been working on a different topic for today's radio program. On today's program, I thought we could talk about a really interesting and really scintillating subject. A lot of people are going to be really excited about what I'd like to talk about today. I'm going to talk about fences. That's right, fences, as in large pieces of interlocking wire or brick erected to keep animals or people in or out. The fence is making a major comeback in Europe, in America, all over the world. Donald Trump is featuring the fence in his campaign to become the Republican nominee for president. Here in Europe, we're seeing more and more fences being built. and Europe's top leaders talking about the idea, they're talking about fences and walls. This is an important little subject. And the reason fences are important, I think, is because they give us an opportunity to peer into a much larger trend. The growing number of fences being erected around this world, literally but also figuratively, is evidence of another major trend and major global development. Now, before we talk about this major trend, this global development that the fence is indicative of, I want to talk about another term, another global trend that we've all experienced. And you've no doubt heard this term, and you, I'm sure, understand what it means. And I'm talking about globalization. Globalization is this notion of greater international integration and cooperation. Globalization is this idea of nations coming together to trade more, nations coming together and cooperating, nations coming together and intermixing culturally and politically. We hear all the time, about how globalized our world is. And it really is. We live in a world where ideas are easily and rapidly exchanged between countries and even between languages. Goods and services are exchanged between countries and cultures cheaply and easily every single day. Millions of goods and services travel between countries. Culturally, I mean, we share one another's culture. We share one another's food. We share one another's lifestyles. We share one another's music and movies. I live here in the UK, right here near Stratford-upon-Avon in the Midlands of the UK. And, you know, within 10 or 15 minutes, I can drive to multiple Indian restaurants, multiple Thai restaurants, Chinese restaurants, Turkish restaurants. It's like I'm living next door to India in that sense, or Turkey. Then there's the internet, Google. With Google, with the internet, we can visit another country instantaneously. With a click of the button, we can be in Greenland or Zimbabwe. We can meet people from other countries. For a few hundred pounds, in most cases, we can hop on an airplane and visit another country, another people, another race, another culture, for a few hundred pounds. That's remarkable. It's remarkable how globalized mankind is. It's remarkable how interconnected this world is. For thousands of years, this just wasn't possible. For thousands of years, there just wasn't a whole lot of travel between regions. For thousands of years, most human beings didn't even leave their village or their local city. Most people would go an entire lifetime never having ventured more than a few miles from the home that they were born into. It wasn't until the Age of Discovery in the 15th, 16th century that human beings were really able to get out and explore the world. But even then, it was just a select few. And then over the next couple hundred years, the steam engine came along, and then the train was developed, and railroads allowed people to travel greater distances. But it hasn't been just until the last 200 years or so that international travel has been possible for the everyday man. Just the past couple hundred years, we've been doing this. But look at the world today. Ideas, technologies, products, food, animals, art, music, religions, all of these can travel the world in a matter of hours and even seconds. This is globalization, and it's really a pretty remarkable phenomenon. It's a remarkable phenomenon. Last week I ran out of Old Spice deodorant, and I'm a little old school when it comes to deodorant. I like my Old Spice, but you can't buy Old Spice off the shelf over here in the United Kingdom. And this put me in a little bit of a quandary. So we just went online, to see if we can find Old Spice, to see if we can import it from the United States. And there it was. We found it right here in England. We ordered it one night. The very next day, my Old Spice was delivered. What a remarkable world. That couldn't happen. That probably couldn't happen 5 or 10 years ago. Our world is so small. Our world is so interconnected. Now, the general view, especially early on as globalization was really gaining steam, the general view was that globalization was this magic potion that we've been waiting for all these years that was going to solve mankind's problems. I'll just read a quote from the Heritage Foundation from a 2008 article. Globalization is one of the most powerful and positive forces ever to have arisen in the history of mankind, and it is redefining civilization as we know it. And the thinking is that the more countries become intertwined, the more connected they become, the more incentive there is for nations to cooperate and to get along. And the more problems will be solved because nations are working together more. And a lot of people believe that globalization and this interconnection between nations would result in a decline in the nation state, a decline in tension and conflict between nations. A lot of people thought that humanity would get along much better in a globalized world because there's incentive to cooperate and work together. Globalization meant the rise of more of a community spirit. There were more meetings, there were more summits, there were more gatherings, there were more discussions. And then we have some amazing technology which minimized the differences between countries and nations and cultures. And the thinking was that there'd be fewer disagreements between nations and peoples because disagreement and tension, because countries were so interconnected, disagreement and tension would hurt everyone involved. It was in no one's interest to go to war. It was in no one's interest to have tension and conflict because everyone would be harmed. As globalization has developed, we've seen the emergence of all kinds of international organizations. Organizations that are comprised of people and representatives and countries from all over the planet. There's the United Nations, the World Trade Organization, the International Criminal Court, the International Energy Agency, the International Seabed Authority. That really exists. There's an international body that exists to talk about and manage the seabeds of the world. There's the International Network for Bamboo. That exists to promote the use of bamboo wood all around the world. There's the International Commission for the Conservation of Atlantic Tunas. That's globalization. The world is coming together and representatives from countries all around the world are sitting down and they're discussing issues and they're solving issues and they're fixing issues. And tension and disunity between nations and disagreements between nations and competition between nations, that's all diminishing because the world is so interconnected. That was the thinking. That has been the thinking. But as I'd like to talk about today, globalization is on its way out. Globalization is diminishing. This article came from the World Economic Forum just yesterday. It was quite miraculous that this same article came out yesterday. At least that's the way I viewed it. But the title of this article was, Has World Trade Reached Peak Globalization? As bad news is mounting concerning the health of the world trade system, one has to wonder, have we reached a peak in the globalization process? Is there still an appetite to continue to promote international integration via the expansion of trade? Or have the tides changed so that we are going to witness a retreat from globalization in parallel with the observed slowdown of international trade? See, people are starting to wonder, are we coming to the end of globalization? And what does it mean that globalization is slowing down? What's replacing it? Well, as we'll talk about after the break, replacing globalization is nationalism. Replacing globalization is a greater urge and greater effort on the part of many nations to put national self-interest first. And that is a worrying trend for you and for me. Okay, we'll take a break and we'll return and talk about nationalism and talk about fences.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program. In the summer of 1926, Herbert W. Armstrong asked himself, "Who am I? What am I? Why am I?" He tried to reason out the answer, but he couldn't. It was a mystery. Not long after that, he was confronted with a mind-disturbing challenge on the theory of evolution and the question of Sunday observance. After many months of virtually night and day intensive study, the answers were revealed with proof that was positive and absolute. These answers, and many more, are thoroughly explained in Mystery of the Ages, which is available to you at no cost or obligation. Time has proven Mystery of the Ages to be the most important book written in nearly 1,900 years. This world's humanity has been blinded to who, what, and why man is, how man appeared on Earth. Man has been mystified by his inability to solve his problems or find answers to the perplexing questions of mankind and the world he inhabits. All these mysteries were long ago revealed by the one supreme authority of all knowledge, but in a coded message, not allowed to be revealed and decoded until our time. In Mystery of the Ages, these great mysteries of life are thoroughly explained in vivid detail. Request your free copy of Mystery of the Ages today. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Okay, well, welcome back. As you've been anticipating, no doubt, now is the time for us to talk about fences. Across the planet, more and more countries are talking about fences, and some nations are even erecting fences. Literally, literal fences are going up in Europe and potentially in the United States. But also, we're seeing the figurative erection of fences around the country, around the world. And a lot of countries are talking about putting up fences as part of an effort to protect their nation, to protect what's in their best interests. Countries are seeking to protect their economies, their own manufacturing industries, their own people, their own cultures. And this trend that we're seeing of countries erecting fences along borders shows that more and more countries are starting to put the interests of themselves first before other countries. And again, as I hinted at before the break there, this is all a sign of a rise in nationalism and nationalist tendencies. Nationalism is basically the love of one's own. Nationalism, in a nationalist, or when a country becomes nationalist, the people and the government, they want to see the interests of their country, their people, their language, their culture, their history supersede the interests of others. I'll just read a quote from an article, again, from Voice Active from yesterday, discussing some of the fences that are going up here in Europe to combat the flood of migrants coming up from the Middle East and North Africa. This article says, the 21st century was supposed to be a time for European openness and cooperation, but increasingly countries are turning to an age-old tactic to isolate themselves. They're building fences along their borders. The refugee crisis sweeping Europe has led a number of countries to tighten their borders, sometimes at the expense of international obligations to respect rights of refugees. In Hungary, down there in southeastern Europe, Hungary is building a 110-mile fence along its border with Serbia. This fence is going to be 13 feet high. And it's doing this because it's receiving tens of thousands of migrants from the Middle East and North Africa. And the country is becoming overwhelmed. And people and the government realizes that it needs to protect itself. So it's building this massive fence, this long fence along its border with Serbia to keep people out. Bulgaria, down there in the same region, has a 50-mile long steel fence along its border with Turkey. And it's about to add another 15 miles to this fence. Bulgaria's fence is 5 meters wide. It's built out of razor wire, and it's monitored by armed security guards. And again, they've built this fence to keep people out, to protect the interests of Bulgaria, or in the case of Hungary, to protect the interests of Hungary. And all across Europe, we're seeing more and more people seeking to protect their nation, from Russia, to protect their nation from migrants, to protect their nation from radical Islamist terrorists. Earlier this week, I watched video footage of government authorities in Macedonia, the Balkan nation of Macedonia. These government authorities were just packing migrants onto a train and then sending the train north into Europe. Macedonia is receiving 3,000 migrants per day. And Macedonian authorities are concerned about this. They don't want them. So they're packing them into trains and they're sending them north to Serbia. They're making them Serbia's problem, someone else's problem. Across Europe, we are seeing a rise in nationalist political parties. And some of these political parties have some pretty extreme views. Some of them actively support Nazism. Some of them want to toss out, you know, all Muslims and confront radical Islam. Some of them want to toss out migrants. But they all want to protect their country. They all want to protect and further the national interests of their country. In Hungary, we have the Jobbik nationalist, far-right nationalist party. And 20% of Hungarians support this far-right nationalist party. It's the third most popular party in Hungary. And they really do have some pretty frightening views. In France, the National Front is the right-wing nationalist party. And it's supported by anywhere from 25 to 30% of the population. And it's against immigrants. And it's critical of France's Muslim population. And it wants to crack down and it wants to get rid of some of the liberal laws that France has toward Muslims. Europe, the world, we're seeing this trend across the world. Nations are going into self-preservation mode. And this is a global trend. As economic crises worsen, as terrorism worsens, as the world becomes more unstable and more predictable, countries are going into self-preservation mode. Countries are enacting policies and practices to protect themselves, to protect their economies, to protect their manufacturing industries. We've seen this in Russia. I don't even have to talk about Vladimir Putin's nationalism. The man invaded Ukraine and took Crimea, all in an effort to augment and expand the Russian nation. He sends his military aircraft into American and British airspace. in a show of Russian strength. He's constantly upgrading the Russian military. Last week, I think it was last week or earlier this month, Vladimir Putin had his security forces destroy food imported from Western nations. Last year, Putin put an embargo on food imported from Western countries. He made it illegal for Russian companies to import food from the West. And then last week, he cracked down. I mean, obviously, there's always a demand for good French cheese and vegetables from Spain. So a black market emerged, trading in Western European food. So, and Vladimir Putin this month has cracked down. So he's had all these people go out, and they're hunting down people who are selling French cheese, and they're taking it out onto the streets and burning it or bulldozing it. Fruit from Spain and Italy is being destroyed. Here's what the Wall Street Journal wrote this week about what Putin's doing here. Russians overwhelmingly back the import embargo, viewing it as a way to strike back against Western sanctions and simultaneously boost domestic food producers. According to the Levada Center pollster, 78% of Russians approved of the ban when it was enacted last year. Some 68% still approve today. Isn't that amazing? The Russians support this import embargo. They don't care that they can't get camembert from France, or they can't get fruit from Spain, or olives from Italy. That doesn't matter. They love the fact that Vladimir Putin is exerting Russian power. They love the fact that Vladimir Putin is being more confrontational with the West and with the United States. See, we're seeing this more and more around the world, where there's a them versus us approach. We see this in Russia. We see this in China. And you see this on a micro level in different nations in Europe. We see this in Germany right now, where there are quite a few Germans who are very upset about the migrants coming into Germany. And some of these migrants, they go into camps or communities when they come into Germany. And we're seeing more and more attacks on these migrant communities by German people who are upset by the inflow, the unchecked inflow of all of these migrants. There's a them versus us approach. In that situation, it's the native German versus the Muslim migrant. In Russia, it's the native Russia versus the West. In China, it's the native Chinaman versus the native Chinaman versus America. This is what Der Spiegel wrote earlier this year, just about Russian nationalism. The country is transforming into a nationalist fortress, and the powers that be are happy to ignore the potentially dangerous implications. The article is having a dig at some leaders in Europe and saying that they don't realize what Russia's doing. The same is happening in China. It's becoming more nationalist. Here's what the National Interest wrote earlier this month on August 3rd. After a decade of reaping the benefits of a soft power offensive, China's peaceful rise took an abrupt turn in the late 2000s. The country that emerged from a unique confluence of events beginning in 2008 has proven a more assertive, authoritarian, and nationalistic rising power. And we see evidence of Chinese nationalism almost daily. China's literally building islands in the South China Sea. It's creating new landmasses in an effort to expand its territory. One of these landmasses, one of these newly created islands, is 220 miles from the Philippines. And get this, it's more than 600 miles from China's coast. So it's not like they're doing this, a stone's throw from the shores of China. This island is 600 miles from China, but it's only 200 miles from the Philippines. China is expanding its military and then parading it before the world. It's engaging in cyber terrorist attacks. It's attacking other countries, including America. It's stealing the intellectual property of other countries and Western corporations. Now, the big news out of China in the past few weeks has been the devaluation of the Chinese currency. China has devalued its currency by at least 3%. Why is Beijing doing this? Well, it's doing this to invigorate its manufacturing industry and to spur its export market. When the Chinese yuan is lower, it's cheaper for foreign countries to buy Chinese goods, or Chinese goods are cheaper. So the thinking is, the hope is, that the manufacturing industry gets more active as Chinese companies work to supply Chinese goods. But it means that Chinese goods are far more inexpensive, and that the goods of other countries are more expensive. It hurts other countries. It hurts American manufacturing. It hurts European manufacturing. It hurts German manufacturing. See, but China, that doesn't matter to China. China has no interest in playing fair. China has no interest in fostering a community spirit, in collaborating and cooperating. The message coming from China right now is, we don't care what happens to the rest of the world. We're saving ourselves. China comes first. And we're seeing that message coming from nations all across the earth: Russia, Iran, Brazil, Argentina, and increasingly from European countries too. Nationalism is returning. Here's another quote from that National Interest article. Since its historic rapprochement with Beijing in the 1970s, America has approached a rising China with an engagement strategy guided by two key assumptions. First, that political liberalization would ultimately follow economic growth. And second, that supporting China's integration into the global order would preempt Beijing from forcibly challenging that order. See, that's what American statesmen have believed and hoped. Well, if we can bring China into the international order, if we can make them a partner and an ally, then they won't do anything to damage it, because it'll only hurt China. But that's just not the case. China might have been happy to cooperate as long as it was benefiting China. But as conditions deteriorate, the true nature is coming to the surface. Globalization has not made the world safer. It has not removed tensions. And what we're seeing now, as world conditions deteriorate, especially financially and economically, what we're seeing now is country after country begin to think more about self-interest and protecting their own. One last quote from this National Interest article. The early tenure of China's avowedly nationalist and politically powerful president, Xi Jinping, has produced a material rise in domestic repression and tensions with the United States and China's neighbors. Xi has expanded the definition of China's core interests, militarized its maritime doctrine, and overseen devastating cyber attacks against the U.S. government. See, to Xi Jinping, China comes first. His motto is simple: make China great. And that's Vladimir Putin's motto: make Russia great. Nationalism even exists here in Britain, though I certainly wouldn't say it's a national policy or a policy that's embraced by the ruling government. But here in Britain, we have Nigel Farage and the United Kingdom Independence Party. And Farage remains popular, even though he had some setbacks in national elections earlier this year. But Nigel Farage believes in a strong, independent Britain. He wants to put Britain first. He despises the European Union because it's destroying Britain, British laws, British values, Britain's culture, the British lifestyle. He's concerned about immigration for exactly the same reason. Farage wants to make Britain great again. And that's why he's popular, because there's still some people here who want Britain to be great again. In America, I think this trend toward nationalism is evident within the stunning popularity of Donald Trump. The man has really taken a lot of people by surprise. He's the front runner now in the race to become the Republican nominee for president. Donald Trump is like the American version of Nigel Farage. Trump is candid and brave. He's totally fearless. He doesn't worry about political correctness. He doesn't mind offending other nations or peoples. Donald Trump's message has a distinct nationalist tone to it. I mean, his campaign slogan is "Make America Great Again." And the central question for Donald Trump on pretty much every issue is, what's best for America? America comes first. American interests are paramount, and they supersede the interests of other nations. This guy, he looks at the world. He's looking at China. He's looking at Russia. He's looking at countries in Latin and South America. He's looking at Japan. And he sees that these nations are increasingly moving away from globalization, and that these nations are beginning to put national interest first. And he knows that if America is going to survive, then America needs to start playing the game the same way. Donald Trump wants to build a fence as well, the Great Wall of Mexico. And like everything Donald Trump does, his fence is going to be way bigger than any others that we see in this world. It's going to be way bigger than the fence in Hungary or Bulgaria. Donald Trump's fence is going to be 2,000 miles long, and he wants to make Mexico pay for it. He wants to protect America. When Donald Trump talks about China or Mexico or Japan, listen to the terms he uses. He uses terms like competitors, opponent. I mean, the language he uses shows that he considers them as rivals. He'll cooperate with these countries, but as long as it serves American interest. He views international relations as competitive more than cooperative. Now, I mean, I'm not criticizing Donald Trump. I'm just observing the state of the world. The world is seeing a rise in nationalist sentiment. And you compare Donald Trump's approach to the approach of the current administration, and even the approach that let's say mainstream politicians would take. They talk about, you know, the international community. They talk about, you know, their partners in China, their partners in Russia. And there's generally a strong sense or a strong determination to do what's best for the global community. But the thing is, that sentiment is not being reciprocated. That sentiment is not being reciprocated. And Americans, a lot of Americans, they know that. So they love it when Donald Trump comes along and he says, put America first. We need to make America great again. This nationalist sentiment is increasing all across the planet. And we're just going to witness this trend intensify more and more. The more extreme conditions become, the more uncertain our world becomes, the more unstable our world becomes, the harder nations will work to take care of their own. Now, we need to think about this. What does this rise, or what does this reemergence of nationalism mean? What does it mean for the world? What does it mean for you? Do we need to be concerned about this? Do we need to be concerned about this? What will the effects be? Well, we can just think about, you know, what is nationalism? Now, a good way to view nationalism, or it's helpful to view nationalism by viewing it on a spectrum. Viewing nationalism on a spectrum. On one side of the spectrum, there's what you might call mild nationalism. And, you know, on this side of the spectrum, a person who's on this side of the spectrum is someone who might, you know, root for their country at the Olympics, or they might root for their nation at the World Cup. Here in the United Kingdom, we just had the Ashes over the summer. The Ashes is a cricket tournament held once every 4 years between Australia and England, and the countries, they play 5 test matches, and it's the best of 5. Now, of course, I was rooting for Australia, even though that didn't go too well for us. But that's what you might call mild nationalism, and it seems fairly harmless. But then on the other side of the spectrum, we have a much more intense nationalism. On the other side of the spectrum, we have World War I and World War II. We have nations pursuing national interest, protecting national interest through military conflict. And that's where we're headed. See, the thing about nationalist tendencies is they tend to intensify. Nationalist tendencies or behavior in one nation tend to arouse nationalist tendencies in other nations. Nationalism breeds nationalism. Competition breeds competition. And we see this happening in the world, right? Iran has just been allowed to acquire nuclear weapons, and that's going to enhance Iran's strategic position in the Middle East. Now Saudi Arabia wants a nuclear weapon, and Saudi Arabia wants to militarize more, and others in the Middle East do too. China is rapidly expanding its territorial acquisitions in the South China Sea, and it's growing in power. Militarily and politically. What's happening with Japan? Well, now we're seeing Japan become more nationalist. We're seeing Japan move away from its post-war pacifist standpoint, and it's actively working to become more militaristic, to become more assertive militarily. It's trying to keep up with China. It's trying to match China. And then the more nationalist Japan becomes, the harder China is going to work. And it just goes back and forth, intensifying. And we're going to see the same thing happen in Europe. We're seeing it happen in Europe. Russia invaded Georgia, then it invaded and took Crimea. It's still invading Ukraine, although no one talks about that anymore. But Vladimir Putin is still poking around down there, taking that country. And look at what's happening in the Baltic countries or Poland. These countries are spending more on their militaries. They're having war games often. They're begging for Germany and Western Europe to come over and help them out. They want more cooperation in Europe to combat Russia. But again, why do Poland and Lithuania and Estonia and Latvia, why do they want more cooperation with Germany? Well, it's not because they're altruistic. It's not because they're selfless. It's not because they all just want to be friendly. They want that because that's in their self-interest. They need Germany and they need Western Europe to be safe from Russia. It's all in response to Russian nationalism. Now, if this trend continues, and it will, there's nothing to suggest that this trend won't continue. This trend will continue, and it will intensify as world conditions deteriorate. And, you know, if we have this global financial meltdown that many people are expecting, we are going to see nationalist tendencies just rocket upwards. You're going to see country after country after country forget the summits, forget the forums, forget the international organizations, and worry first and foremost about their people, their economy, their manufacturing industry. There's going to be more tensions. There's going to be more rivalry. There's going to be more disputes, more conflicts. And ultimately, there's bound to be more wars between countries and regions. You know, we need to be concerned about this reemergence of nationalism, and we can expect there to be less cooperation, less collaboration, and as I said, more tension and more conflict. The world is still globalized, at least in the sense that we can travel and that we're very interconnected. But globalization as a force for unity and cooperation and cohesion has failed. And nationalism is now becoming a destabilizing force for the international community. I thought I could just finish with a scripture here. Mr. Flurry, I'm not able to listen to every trumpet daily, but the ones I've listened to, it seems like he's been coming to 2 Timothy 3 quite often. Well, as I said, at least the ones I've tuned in to. But here in 2 Timothy 3, verse 1, it says, "This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come, for men shall be lovers of their own selves." Men, human beings, are going to put self first. On an individual level, in the way they live their lives, in their lifestyle, and the decisions that they make each day. But you know, a love of one's own country is really a love of one's own self. Our country is really an extension of our self. And we're just going to see nationalism intensify. I had some quotes here from Mr. Armstrong, and I had a few more scriptures, but time disappears quickly when you're doing radio live. So I'll go ahead and leave it there, but pay attention to this rise in nationalism, to this reemergence in nationalism. And as I mentioned there at the start of the program, think about this. Think seriously about the world we live in. Think seriously about your community. Think seriously about the future. And don't be afraid to ask yourself some tough questions. It was good to be with you. Thanks for listening.